not meant for her. Good parenting, she thinks, when she has concern for her son's well-being. Josh wanted to meet a boy. It wasn't complicated. He was having a difficult time allowing her into a world that was already fraught with self-loathing and discomfort. Josh simply wanted to meet some boy, and her prying put him on edge. A crush? A teenager in an early approximation of love? It was sweet. She did not cry, but she pre-cried. Reminder, I love you very much. That is all. She sent the text. The pre-crying turned to crying. A good cry. A sad, but good cry. The anchors on the television glanced over at her with concern, but continued to report the news. She felt a hand rub her back gently. Thanks, faceless old woman, she said. That feels nice. Her phone buzzed. She looked down. Josh had texted back. I want to meet Troy. The Voice of Night Vale. And now the community calendar. Saturday is a softball game between Night Vale Community Radio and Night Vale Local News TV. I don't mind telling you, this is not a game I enjoy. The creatures that work in television news, because of the shape and quantity of their appendages, often hold the bat in ways that are unsettling to the human eye. They usually win by creeping out the other team so much that the opposing team all goes to sit mutely on the bench while the TV news team plays their way to a win on an empty field. Come out for what should be a great game. Sunday is the annual Imaginary Corn Festival and Fun Fair, celebrating our town's most important crop. Come try out some simple and healthy imaginary corn recipes and take part in a costume contest sponsored by the Night Vale Daily Journal. They are asking that everyone dress up as the decline of the printed word in a society reverting to a state of brainless animality. The best costume wins 1 year of not being forced to purchase several Daily Journal subscriptions by newspaper employees armed with hatchets. There will also be rides and carnival games, and apprehensive excitement and hoped-for futures, and stomach pains, and sweat, and disappointment, and sweat, and sweat, and love, and glances that mean more than they should but less than they need to, and a dunking booth. Monday will be free sample day at the Sheraton Funeral Home. Tuesday will be reversed. We will rise tired from sleep to find that it is night and brush plaque onto our teeth. We will move backwards to work where we will undo spreadsheets, lose ideas to dissipating meetings, and unsee hundreds of cat pictures. Then, returning with a buzz of caffeine to our homes, we will spit liquid alertness into cups and, refreshed but groggy, return to dreams that we faintly, just faintly, remember. Wednesday is Smell Like a Pirate Day. Everyone in town is encouraged to get in on the wacky fun by not bathing for weeks and rubbing yourself with ash and blood. Thursday, the employees at Dark Owl Records will be holding a séance to reach the ghost of Patsy Cline. If you'd like to come by and help, just enter quietly and please wear a bolo tie. We're all wearing bolo ties now. And don't wear those shoes. God, do we have to tell you everything? Maybe it's better if you don't come by. Records are not for sale, as usual. We are skipping Friday this week, but we'll make up for it by having double Friday next week. Mark your schedules. This has been the community calendar. Oh, I've just been handed an update. The secret police would like to retract their earlier statement that they will be out in large numbers tonight. That was not meant to be known. You think you want to know things, but then you know them, and it's too late. You didn't want to know that. You didn't want to know that at all, the secret police's press release reads. This is one of those things you will wish you had never known. The statement goes on to say that memory is a tenuous human construct, and nothing matters in the grand scheme, so whatever. In other news, a man in a tan jacket holding a deer skin suitcase was seen. I don't remember anything about him or why this was news, but it had seemed important at the time. I wrote it down. Say the important thing about the man in the tan jacket. What was it? What was I supposed to say? 20. It's not a good idea, Josh. Why? His shouts were muffled behind his locked bedroom door. Because. In the space after the word because, Diane thought through what the next words could be. Because he is a dangerous person? Maybe. Troy doesn't seem to be a danger, but anyone could be a dangerous person. Because he will only let you down? Probably. He had disappeared before. He could disappear again. He could also just be a terrible father. Because it is complicated. More complicated than you can process with your young brain, she wanted to say. Because she didn't have a reason exactly, but felt a storm on its way. A confluence of Troy's reappearance and Josh's interest and the disappearance of Evan, and she wanted to wrap herself around Josh and keep him from all of whatever was going to happen next. Because I said so, Diane said. There was no audible response. I have to go, she said. Where are you going? It's 7 o'clock. Out. With who? With Don? They both took the expected tone and said their lines as if from a script. But the scene had gotten mixed up and reversed somehow. They both wanted to put it back the way it was supposed to be, but neither of them knew how to do that. She was going out to try to find Troy again, perhaps make another visit to the movies. She needed to confront Troy now, before Josh did. Josh would inevitably find him, so it would be better if she could facilitate that on her own terms, rather than on her son's, or worse, Troy's. Also, given that she had hit a dead end in her search for Evan at work, and with Dawn, the only place she could get any more information was at the Hall of Records. But citizens were not allowed to know where public records were kept. She figured they were somewhere in City Hall basement. But unless you had high-level clearance to get into the records offices, you would become stuck in the elaborate, tricky mazes designed to trap news reporters and nosy genealogists. The other option was to go to the public library. Few people came back from a visit to the library. There was one girl, a few years ago, that survived the summer reading program at the Nightvale Public Library. The girl, Tamika Flynn, defeated the librarian that had imprisoned her and her classmates, using the switchblade hidden in every hardback edition of Eudora Welty's touching homecoming novel, The Optimist's Daughter. But few who have seen a librarian up close have survived, or been in a physical condition to communicate. Perhaps Diane could use Troy. Police officers have access to all kinds of databases. If Diane could just have a few minutes searching Troy's office computers, she could probably find something about Evan. Just something to point her in a new direction. Real estate records, a birth or wedding announcement, any number of the mandatory dream journals that he would have had to file with the city if he were a legal resident and, if he didn't, some kind of prison record. To do that, She needed to be away from Josh more than she had been in his entire life. And in order to do that, she needed to keep up the imaginary thing with Dawn. Yes, with Dawn. Why don't you have Dawn over for dinner? Diane did not reply. Josh opened his door, his wings flapping in an effortless blur. Mom? There was no tie. Devon helped me figure out that my dad's real name is Troy Walsh. We couldn't find a photo, but Devon's seeing if his friend can get one. I want to meet my dad. So now I've told you the truth. I've opened up like you keep asking me to do. Now your turn. You've been going out on dates. Sometimes these dates go all night, and okay, so that's a thing, I guess, and I don't need the specifics. But I've never had a dad, and you won't let me meet him. And now you're dating someone seriously, and you won't let me meet him either. Dawn's a she, Diane corrected automatically based on a reality that was irrelevant to her lie, and regretted it immediately. So you just really don't want me to have a dad, do you? He said, also automatically based on a hurt that was not irrelevant to his life. And then immediately, no. I'm sorry. No, that's fine. I didn't mean... That's fine. He was flustered, back on the defensive and unsure of how he had gotten there. Diane did nothing. She breathed, unintentionally. The faceless old woman who secretly lives in their home crawled by on the ceiling, but neither of them noticed. Josh matched Diane's stare for a second, then slithered backwards and shut the door. There are a lot of things we don't understand about orange juice, the house thought. Diane walked to the kitchen and swung open the fridge. She did not want anything from inside it, and so stood in front of the open fridge for several moments, unsure of what she was doing next. Her phone buzzed. A text. Hello. She texted back to the unknown number. Hello? Diane stared at the carton of orange juice in the fridge, at the bright round fruit logo, its straw hat shading unseen eyes on the pocked face, a tight grin with perfect human teeth, separated slightly, and a pink leaf-shaped tongue. She didn't know why she was fixating on the orange juice, but she didn't know why she was doing anything. Troy was everywhere. There were so many of him, and Josh wanted to meet just one of him. It was a meeting she didn't think she was going to be able to prevent, so she needed more time to understand who Troy was now and what he wanted. And then there was Evan. Why was she looking so hard for Evan? It seemed to her that her life had slipped loose somehow, its progression all off track. Josh and Troy, that was one thing. But she felt a larger shift, and that shift had all started when Evan disappeared and became forgotten by all but her. There was something wrong in her life, in Night Vale, maybe in the world. The magnitude of the thing was unclear, but wherever it was, she was inside it. Her phone buzzed. It's been a while. She didn't know what that meant, and didn't want to reply. She should go to the movie theater. She was going to go to the movie theater. She walked back to Josh's closed door. Josh, I'm sorry. I know this all doesn't make sense to you. It doesn't all make sense to me either. Nothing. I love you. A long nothing. I'm not perfect. I'm not. I'm sorry. There came a faint, love you too. She exhaled. Her phone buzzed again. Do you remember me? She stared at the phone. The area code of the texts was a postage stamp size photo of a burnt out forest alive with luminescent snails in an array of vivid colors. She didn't recognize that area code, but it wasn't local. Buzz. You remember me, Diane. Who is this? She typed. Nothing. Nothing. She was tired of waiting for things to happen to her. She would make something happen. She would just call the number. She put the phone to her ear. It buzzed warm in her ear, and she yelped at the proximity. Another text. Evan. There was a photo attached. It was a man. She was sure she had never seen his face before. He was wearing a tan jacket and holding a small brown suitcase. It looked to be leather. He had dark gray slacks and a light blue shirt open at the collar. She looked at his face. She stared for a long time, trying to recall his eyes, his mouth, the curve of his nose, his hairline. It wasn't that he was unfamiliar to her. It was that she couldn't keep her eyes focused on him. Every time she would look at his cheeks or his ears or his chin, she found herself instead looking at his tan jacket or his leather suitcase. And when her eyes did land on his face, it was like the first time she had ever seen him. There was no recognition. Buzz. Remember? Evan. I remember, but no one else does. No one ever does, Diane. I've been looking for you. Where are you? Diane was reaching for a pen to write down this number. She needed physical, not just digital, evidence of his existence. I'll come to you. She began to type, actually, I was just heading out, let's meet up in town, while grabbing her purse and walking to the front door. Halfway into writing that, buzz. Here, said the text. There was a loud knock on the front door directly in front of her. Diane suddenly remembered that she had left the fridge open. 21. Diane was sitting in a corner booth at the Moonlight All-Night Diner, without any clear idea how she got there. She glanced to her right and saw her car parked in the lot. Don't turn your head. Across the table sat a man wearing a tan jacket. He looked familiar. Keep your eyes on me, Diane. In her lap were some notes in her handwriting. One said, Evan McIntyre. One said, King City. The second one was circled twice and underlined. How had she ended up here? Think back through it. What had been done to her? Or what had she done to herself? She felt like she was outside of herself, looking at her life through a stranger's eyes, and she didn't love what she saw. She looked back across the table, and the man was not there. She blinked for a second, and he returned. Keep your eyes on me, he said, or you will forget. Evan, Diane said uncertainly. My name is not Evan, said the man whose name was not Evan. Then he said his name. Evan. Diane said uncertainly. He repeated his actual name. Evan, I don't care what your name is. I'm sorry, I don't. Why did you disappear from the office? She wondered how long she had been at the Moonlight, and if Josh was worried about her. She worried more about his worrying than she worried about him. At the same time, she felt a victory inside herself that Evan was real, that he was sitting in front of her, and that there was some confirmation that he had existed and had worked at her office. The man sat up straight, widening his shoulders, a gesture simultaneously receptive and defensive. Laura came by the table and poured them both coffee. Diane ordered lunch. Laura drew a picture of a cow skull on her notepad, using her finger and a small pot of ink clipped to her pad. It was a detailed picture that took her a few minutes. while Evan and Diane patiently waited for her to be done, and when she showed them, they both agreed it captured the beauty and impermanence of physical life. Before heading back to the kitchen, Laura said, "I'm sorry, dear, what did you order again?" "Just the coffee," Evan said. "Thank you." "You have pretty eyes," Laura said. She didn't know why she had said it. She also did not believe in free will, but that is not important to mention. "Me or him?" Diane said, jokingly, although she did want to know. "What, dear?" "Which of us do you mean?"
"I don't understand."
"Do you mean me or Evan?"
"Who's Evan, dear?"
Diane looked back to Evan, but he wasn't there.
"You came here alone, Diane, just a few minutes ago."
There was only one coffee cup on the table, only one place setting. The naugahyde chair across from her was empty and pushed snugly under the table.
"Never mind."
"Thanks," she said. Laura turned to leave, her branches swinging through the empty air where Evan had been. Diane breathed with effort. She looked where Evan's eyes would have been. She could not recall what they looked like, but she could guess their approximate location. She did not see him appear. He was just there again, matching her gaze. She wanted to look away. "Focus," he said, visible again. "This is hard for me." "This is hard for me, too. Almost no one remembers me. Not even back where I'm from. But you do. You remember me. I need your help, Diane." Diane gripped her coffee cup hard. She thought of the last time she talked with Josh, and she let that anger carry her through the strangeness of the conversation. "You don't just get to ask me for help. I don't know you. You show up at my office. You insinuate yourself into my memories, and then you vanish from my life. You keep vanishing even now."
"It's not something I can control."
"I don't want excuses." She slid a pen and a piece of blank paper across the table, her eyes still on his. "I want you to write your name down." He opened his mouth. "Do it quickly. No talking." Diane is a nice person. Nice people are not good at being direct. Nice people do not like making others feel rushed or indebted or insulted. Nice people like to make others feel nice. It is difficult to maintain niceness while being assertive. You can be respectful and assertive, of course, but that has nothing to do with being nice. "And while you're doing that, I'm going to take pictures of you. I'm not going to be put in this position of ridicule again." She held her phone up. "I'm not trying to ridicule you, Diane. I'm happy to help you in whatever way I can," he said, writing out his name on the page. Diane looked at the name, nodded, and immediately forgot it. "Help me? Evan, I don't remember how I got to this diner. Do you know how uncomfortable that makes me?" Laura returned before he could reply. She placed a bowl of fruit and a pile of pumice stones in front of Diane. She refilled both coffees. "Here's your Greek salad," Laura said, "and here's more coffee, handsome." She glanced at the man and raised her eyebrows at Diane, grinning. Diane did not move her eyes from the man. Laura shrugged, walked away, and forgot what had just happened. Diane took several pictures of him. "It's hard to explain," he said. "Try," she interrupted. The man in the tan jacket holding a deerskin suitcase explained. Diane understood. She nodded. She protested. She decided she would never do what he said, and then she agreed to think about it. She took a sip of coffee. She had no memory of what he had just said. "You'll need this." He handed her a slip of paper that said, "King City."
"What is this?" she said.
Instead of answering,
He pointed at the man in the white apron with blonde hair walking past their table. That is who I mean. That is who I mean. The man in the tan jacket whispered in Diane's left ear, even as he sat across the table from her, his mouth not moving. Troy? She followed Troy with her eyes. How do you know him? She turned back to where the man in the tan jacket had been sitting. He was, of course, gone. His chair was pulled out, his coffee half empty. Some currency that was clearly marked as American, but that she did not recognize lay on the table. I already explained that to you. Remember? Came his whisper in her right ear. Give that paper to Josh. I want to meet Josh. What do you want with Josh? At her son's name, her bewilderment tunneled into a feeling of intense protection. Like hell, anyone would be dragging a child into this mess. There was no answer. She looked out the window. The man in the tan jacket was running out to the desert. She could just barely see him at the edge of the parking lot's radius of light. His arms were swinging wildly, his suitcase swinging along. His legs were flailing, great puffs of sand kicked up behind him, his head thrown back, sweat running down his face, visible even from where she sat. The kind of run that was from something and not toward. Then he left the faint edge of the light and was gone. She looked down at the slip of paper in her hand. It read, King City. She gathered up her things, hiding the pen in her bag, mortified that she'd left a potential misdemeanor out on the table for anyone to see. She was still uncertain how long she had been at the diner. Had she said goodbye to Josh? Did he know where she was? She would text him. Before leaving, she scanned the diner for Troy. She couldn't see him. Jackie waved at her from the counter. They exchanged pleasantries. There was something odd about the way Jackie considered her, thoughtful and suspicious. Diane tried to seem completely at ease. They exchanged some words that didn't mean much. Then things turned. Diane said, What? And Jackie shook her head impatiently. Never mind. What do you got there? She nodded at the paper in Diane's hand. Diane realized that Jackie was holding an identical paper, but couldn't get her mind to rest on that fact long enough to become curious about it. Nothing, said Diane, and stuffed the paper into her purse. It stayed in her purse. Lucky, said Jackie, and turned back to her coffee, tapping the edge of her paper against the counter. Diane still didn't understand, but Jackie seemed grumpy, and so Diane let the conversation end there. She said some sort of casual goodbye, and Jackie threw it back in her face as a sarcastic joke, which Diane thought was unnecessary and rude. As she walked to her car, she reached into her bag for her keys. Her hand came across some crumpled paper. She pulled it out. King City, it said. Why did she have that? Where would this piece of paper have come from? She tossed it on the ground, and then, feeling guilty, picked it up to carry around to the dumpster. Before she could toss it in, there was a crashing sound next to her, which made her jump. Troy was there, throwing big bags of trash into the dumpster. Oh, hey, he said, and ducked quickly through the back door. She seemed to be holding a piece of paper. She did not know what it was, or where it could have come from, or how much she would later regret keeping it. She put it in her purse. 22. Jackie was at a dead end, investigation-wise. In terms of tacos, she was doing fine. Judged on her ability to never be able to let go of a slip of paper with her left hand, it was all going great. But trying to figure out what the hell was going on was not going well at all. She had spent the night with open eyes, trying to will her mind to be just as open. There had to be something she had missed, some connection to be made in the events and individuals moving about in the memory of her day. But if there was, she couldn't see it. Maybe she wasn't smart enough. Or maybe the world wasn't. Maybe the world wasn't smart enough to put together a story that made sense. Maybe it could only stick together random elements randomly, forming, as Shakespeare had famously written, a show of senseless movement and circumstance that ultimately doesn't amount to much at all. The next morning found her with only one lead left. She had seen that blonde man at her mother's house, and she had seen him outside of the mayor's office, and she had seen him at the Moonlight All-Night Diner. It was time to talk to that man, and to find out how he was involved in whatever it was this whatever was. She drove to the Moonlight all night. It was the same crowd as always, which is to say that there were many of the regulars, and also to say that certain people were always in the Moonlight all night, always at the same booths, always working on plates of food that never seemed to go away. It's a sign of a good diner to have customers who are stuck in time. A well-known rule of eating is that if there are no time loop customers, the place probably isn't worth even ordering a plate of fries. Jackie sat in her regular spot at the counter. "Hiya, Jackie," said Laura, moving with difficulty behind the counter, her thick, woody branches scraping against it. "You hungry?" She bent a fruit-laden branch toward her invitingly. "Thanks, Laura, but just a coffee." Laura pushed her way toward the coffee machine, her branches knocking over tubs of ketchup and mayonnaise and stacks of empty water glasses as she went. Jackie watched the kitchen. There was no blonde man. She turned to survey the room. Diane Creighton was getting out of her booth. It seemed like there was probably someone with her, but Jackie couldn't remember who. She looked back at Diane's table, and her heart began to pound. And then she looked at the kitchen again, and couldn't understand why her heart was pounding. Diane walked by her. Jackie decided to stop her, talk a little, make it seem casual. She needed to know if Diane actually was involved somehow. "Hey, Diane!" Jackie said with a casual half-salute. Diane jumped and gasped. "Easy," Jackie said, bringing her saluting hand down to pat the air with a "Whoa! Just saying hi." "Sure, I was..." Diane took a breath. "I was all caught up in my thoughts." She waved her hand to indicate where her thoughts were. She laughed to indicate that she was fine and unbothered. The combination of hands and laughter indicated she was startled and uncomfortable. "Totally get it. Cool." "I am sorry I have to go. I hope the tear I gave you is working out okay." "Yeah, the tear. It's great. I'm sure it'll fly off the shelf real soon. Always demand for tears." "How's your mother?" Jackie gave her a hard look. "What do you know about my mother?" Diane frowned with her whole face. "What?" The conversation went wrong from there. Jackie felt Diane hiding something from her. It felt like everyone was hiding something from Jackie. The whole world, a game of hide-and-seek she had never consented to play. She gave up on the conversation and turned back to the coffee. Diane smiled, but only with her mouth. "I'll be seeing you, Jackie." "I'm completely visible." Jackie thought this was a pretty good joke, but Diane didn't laugh. Jackie's coffee had arrived in a mug, with the logo of a strangely proportioned giant of a man leering out at the world. Underneath it was a phrase that had been vandalized by some sharp object, chipping most of it away and leaving only, "Call 462ME. The mug had a smudge where blood had been incompletely wiped off. She sipped, and she waited. She waited, and she sipped. The act of sipping was an act of waiting. Sometimes she didn't even put the coffee in her mouth, only held her lips to the rim and then put the mug back down. The woman with the clipboard was there, as usual, and each time that Jackie took a sip, the woman would write something down. She appeared to be working with a woman with an earpiece standing outside, as she would occasionally wave wildly to her, and the other woman would wave wildly back, and then they would quickly and nonchalantly look away, loudly whistling and saying, "I don't know that person. If you asked me to define a stranger, I'd say that lady. Couldn't know her less." Jackie looked back at the kitchen, and there was the man again, blonde, handsome in all of the expected ways, and in this way not handsome, staring at her and flipping endless amounts of burgers into the air, a fountain of burgers with a meat splash pattern in a 5-foot radius around him. She hopped up from the stool. The woman with the clipboard started writing frantically on the clipboard, and Laura said, "Hey, Jackie, where are you going?" but couldn't get up because her branches were caught in the ice cream freezer door. Jackie ran to the back, where the steel-swinging doors of the kitchen were. She slammed through them into a kitchen with no one in it. All the burgers were still there, evidence of the man's recent existence. She walked slowly past the prep table, stopping to look under it, where the pans and plates were stored. No one. There was no back door that she could see. He had to be in here. A soft clank. Some hanging spatulas moving. She crept toward them, looking around at the large dishwashing sink and the cold storage room. The cold storage room. A heavy magnetized door. Was it slightly ajar? She reached out her hand, slowly, so slowly, fingers around the handle. The kitchen was empty and silent. No one out in the diner seemed to be watching. Even the woman with the clipboard had returned to her usual business of marking off new entrances. She was alone, and no one would help her if anything went wrong. "Story of my life," she said, and flung open the magnetized door. Shelves of meat and produce? Nothing else. There was nowhere she could see to hide. A crash from behind her. The blonde man pushed away the pile of plates he had been hiding behind in a shout of broken ceramics. She tore after him, and they both slammed through the steel-swinging doors. She was just behind him as they weaved through tables and surprised customers. The clipboard woman was adding something up on her clipboard, mouthing the equations as she went, apparently uninterested in the chase. Jackie sprinted through the diner as quickly as a person can sprint after a stranger through a diner, which was not quickly at all. The blonde man burst out the front door, and Jackie was moments behind him. She was younger, and she was faster, and she would catch him. Her feet slapped hard on the asphalt, so hot in the midday sun that she could feel the heat through the soles of her shoes. "I've got you," she shouted, before she had him. "Troy," Diane shouted, running from her car. "Troy, I need to talk to you." The blonde man broke right, toward the road and the abandoned gas station across the street. Diane and Jackie both turned to follow and collided with each other. Subsequently, they both collided with the ground. "God damn it!" Jackie shouted into the blacktop, a long red scratch on her face. Diane had the makings of a bruise on her thigh, but didn't know it yet. They both looked toward the gas station, but the man was gone. "God damn it!" she repeated over and over with her palm onto the asphalt. Diane glared at her, rubbing her leg. "Why are you chasing Troy?" she asked. Jackie glared at her. "Diane Creighton," John had said. "Diane was involved, and didn't this prove it?" "Why was I chasing him? Why do you have that paper?" Diane didn't understand what that question had to do with anything that had just happened. Jackie looked back at the gas station. "I almost had him, Diane. That weird dude?" You almost had him. What did that weird dude do to you, Jackie? Jackie tried to come up with an explanation as to why her actions made sense. Her head hurt. He just stares and smiles. What's his deal? I mean, maybe you're too young to understand this, but you don't just run after people because you want to know what their deal is. Diane had slipped into didactic mom voice without meaning to, and they both heard it. Ah, so the mature approach is to body tackle people in parking lots. Awesome. I'm sure when I'm as old as you, I'll remember that. Diane sighed and stood up, seeing if her body could still do that. She looked the teenager up and down. If you want to be treated as an adult, Jackie, you have to act like it. In her head, Jackie heard the voice of her ex-friend, Noelle Connolly, brimming with parental condescension. Oh, Jackie, did you ever just think of turning 20? Screw you, she said. Oh, good. That's good. Diane turned and walked back to her car. Jackie walked after her. Hey, where do you think you're going? How do you know that guy? How did you know his name was Troy? Like, seriously, what's his deal? Diane collected herself and spoke with only a mild tremble. This is none of your business. Troy is someone from my past, and I'm trying to talk to him so that things will be right with my son. My son, who is the only child I am interested in raising right now. You'll have to find someone else to do that for you. She slammed herself into her car. Jackie made a gesture through the window that succinctly responded to many of the points made. Diane shrugged and reversed the car out of the spot. I'm finding out who that guy is and what you have to do with him, Jackie shouted after her. I'm getting to the goddamn bottom of this. You just stay out of my way while I do. Diane responded with acceleration. Jackie threw the paper after her. Screw you, Jackie said. King City, the paper said, back in her hand. She has no idea what she's talking about, Diane and Jackie said simultaneously and separately. But about this, they both had their doubts. 23. Sitting in her car, which sat in front of her house, which was not thinking anything at the time, Diane took out her phone and the paper that Evan had written on. Diane did not remember much from her meeting with Evan at the diner, but she did remember he had texted her. She had also taken photos of him. She had also asked him to write down his name. She remembered Jackie chasing after Troy. Diane, thinking of this moment, rubbed the burn marks on her left forearm. Why was Jackie looking for Troy? There was a great pit of unknown under the rickety bridge of her and Josh's relationship, and every time she looked down, the pit was deeper than before. She felt annoyed with Jackie, but furious with Troy. Another young person caught in the wake he was creating as he moved lightly through his careless, carefree life. She looked at the piece of paper. It said, King City, and on the back it had Evan's name. His name was not Evan. She looked at the name on the page and said it aloud. She said it again and then put the paper down. Evan McIntyre, she said aloud and shrugged. That's just what it's going to be then. Diane opened the photos and looked at one of the pictures she'd taken of Evan at the diner. He was wearing a tan jacket. She stared at the picture, then closed her eyes, hoping to burn the image into her mind, or onto the backs of her retinas, or into the mystic cloud of the collective unconscious. Whatever it is that makes us remember images. She was no scientist. She muttered his name with her eyes shut, trying to hold on to the image of him. His eyes, nose, mouth, hairline. Nothing. She looked back at the photo. She took in his lips and thought about the many adjectives that could be used to describe them. Then she looked at his nose and took in the adjectives that could be used to describe it. Upon staring at the nose, she forgot those adjectives she thought about the lips. She looked back at the lips and forgot the nose. She never even got to the ears. Diane searched her text history and tried texting Evan back. Another way to remember someone is to create more memories with that person. The more there is to forget, the longer forgetting takes. She typed, "Hey, good talking to you the other night. Let's do it again." It sounded like a date. She deleted the text without sending. A horsefly sitting on the right rear headrest flew to the left rear headrest. Diane saw it do this. She wrote a different text. "Evan, I can't remember what we talked about. Can you come back?" She hit send. Her thumb seized up in a sharp moment of pain. She didn't cry out, just winced. Her text remained unsent. She tried again. Another sharp pain, almost to the bone. A small bead of blood ballooned on the middle of her right thumb. This is a common feature on smartphones. If a person is unreachable by text, or if the underground government agencies that control the phone companies don't want a person to be reachable, the phone is allowed to cause mild physical harm. She put the thumb to her mouth to clean it off. The day before, the phone had caught fire while she tried to call him. She smelled burnt hair most of the morning and had to stop by the drugstore to get calamine lotion for the top of her ear and then stop by a garden nursery and place the side of her head onto aerated topsoil for 15 minutes, per her doctor's orders. She didn't know why the doctor would tell her to do that, but no one knows why doctors do anything they do. Doctors are mysterious creatures. Diane looked at the horsefly on the left rear headrest through the rearview mirror. She stared at the fly. She could feel the fly staring back. It shuffled its half-dozen legs. It moved a little left, a little right. It stood, tiny and alone, in the middle of what was, to it, a vast cloth field. There was no place to hide. "I see you," she said. "It's not what you think," the horsefly said. "What do I think?" "You think I'm spying." "Yes, I do. And what is it you are doing instead, Josh?" He flew to the front of the car and landed on the dashboard. "I wanted to hop a ride with you." "I'm going to work." "Then I'll just fly." "You will do no such thing. You walk or ride. You are not to fly outside until you are 18. It's dangerous." The horsefly moped. "Josh, you can't hide in my car. How am I supposed to trust you if I can't trust that my private space is private?" "I didn't think you'd see me." "That's the trust thing I'm talking about." "I'm sorry." Despite the fact that horseflies are incapable of dropping their heads in a gesture of penitence and submission, and despite the fact that, even if they could do this, it would be so subtle as to be unnoticeable by human eyes, she heard this action in Josh's voice. She didn't need to see her son in human form to understand his physical language. Even when Josh took the form of a sentient patch of haze, he rarely did, only once or twice after watching a scary movie, when he had felt that, if he had no physical form, no monsters or ghosts could get him, she could still tell when he was rolling his eyes, or slumping, or smirking, or not paying attention. "I can always see you, Josh. I'm your mom. You could be anything, and I would know it was you." Josh didn't say anything. He vigorously rubbed his legs together because that was something he had seen flies do, but he didn't know why they did that. "Why did you want to ride downtown with me?" "Just to hang out, maybe go to the video store or something?" "First, you don't get to skip school. You understand me?" "Yes." "Second, you don't get to hide from me. That is deceitful, Josh." "Okay, okay." "And third," she hesitated, "you were going to dig up records on your dad, right?" Josh didn't respond. "I don't want you doing that. He's your father, yes. But I don't trust him." "You did at one point." "I raised you for 15 years. I fed you and clothed you. I loved you and still do. I love you because you have been with me for 15 years. I am your mother because we have been together your whole childhood. I have earned you as my son. Troy does not get to be your father simply because he participated in your creation. Troy does not get to earn your love as a son because you are biologically his. I have done the work. I have put in the time. I have loved you. Troy does not get to be my equal in your life because he has not earned it. I need to protect myself, and I need to protect you. So promise me you will leave this all alone. And I will promise you that I will find out more about him. And when the time is right, I will tell you. Okay, the horsefly said. He didn't sound like he thought it was okay. Get moving, so you don't miss your bus. No more of this, okay? Diane pressed her finger to the automatic window button on the front passenger side. With a robotic whir, the window cracked open. The horsefly flew up and out in a loose spiral. I love you, she called out. No flying. Okay, came back the soft buzz from the human boy with the horsefly face. Later, she would go over this conversation again and again in her head, one of the last they would have before he disappeared. 24. Jackie hit the steering wheel of her car, which did not hurt the car at all. Sometimes it is easy to forget which things in the world can feel pain and which cannot. What did Diane know about this? What was her connection? Could she be the mastermind behind the blonde man and the man in the tan jacket holding a deerskin suitcase, and maybe even Jackie's mother's strange behavior? John Peters certainly seemed to think she was involved. And why not Diane? Wasn't Night Vale a town full of hidden evils and the secretly malevolent? That was what the tourism board's new brochure said right on the front. A town full of hidden evils and the secretly malevolent. Along with a picture of a diverse group of townsfolk, smiling and looking up at the camera in the windowless prison they would be kept in until enough tourists visited town to buy their release. If it was possible that Diane was behind any of this, then Jackie needed to talk to someone who knew her. Sure, she seemed nice, but lots of people and things seem nice yet are terrible underneath. Like poisonous berries, rabid squirrels, or a smiling god. Is that a smile? This was how it was that Jackie ended up at the Night Vale Elementary multipurpose room, which was, among its multiple purposes, the headquarters of the Night Vale PTA. Diane had been the treasurer since back when her son was a student at the school, and had kept it up even as he had gone on to high school and puberty and the myriad physical forms it had brought him. Josh was just a few years younger than Jackie, and she liked him well enough. Some of his shapes were a little scary, especially the dream forms, but in general, he was a good kid. Jackie had always hoped that things would turn out well for him, in the vague way one feels goodwill toward semi-strangers. May his life turn out better than hers had. The multipurpose room was a cluttered space befitting its many uses. There was a small stage where school plays could be put on. There were stacks of folding chairs for PTA meetings and the various support organizations, alcohol, narcotics, immortality, that used the room after school. There was a full bloodstone circle for bloodstone demonstration and worship, and a child-sized bloodstone circle so that the students could try out the rites on their own. There was also a popcorn machine, but no one was allowed to touch it. No one was quite sure why touching it was disallowed, but warnings like that are worth heeding in Night Vale, so it had been left alone for decades, in its supremely inconvenient place in the center of the room. Diane, Jackie said, hoping she wouldn't be there. The best person to run into would be Susan Willman, who was known to be chatty and who was not on friendly terms with Diane. Susan would also be thrilled to pass on any gossip she had about Diane. She also, Jackie knew, would be only too happy to make up gossip about Diane, so perhaps she wouldn't be the best option after all. Jackie would have been fine with an empty room, so she could root around in PTA records and check for files or notes from Diane that might give her any new information. Her worst-case scenario was,
"Oh, hi, Jackie," Steve Carlsberg said. "Diane's not around. I'm just tidying up for a meeting in here."
He gestured, and in gesturing knocked a cardboard box of files off a table, spilling them all over the floor.
"Whoopsie-daisy. Let me just pick those up. Now what can I help you with?"
Jackie sighed. Steve was fine. He was a nice man. But he was so... he was just... well, he was Steve Carlsberg. There's always that guy. And Steve was him. "Hi, Steve," she said, and helped him pick up the files. As she did, her paper did its mystical yo-yoing bit, which she had ceased to even notice. Steve gasped.
"Wow! So you got one of those papers. Lucky!"
He whistled, hands on his hips.
"Lucky," she said. "I can't work. I've been seeing visions, and some creepy blonde dude is following me around town. Plus, some days I feel like I can't walk, can't hardly breathe. Yeah, so this paper is super lucky."
Steve nodded.
"That sounds like a blast. Nothing strange ever enters into my life, turning it upside down and forcing me to go on a journey of discovery in order to write things again. Not that I mind, of course. The PTA is rewarding in its own way, and it's nice to get involved with what Janice is up to."
Janice was Steve's stepdaughter. Her mother was the sister of Cecil, the local radio host. Steve and Cecil did not get along at all. It was something of a local joke, although Jackie guessed it was less funny if it was your family that had that kind of feud in it. She'd always felt bad for Janice, but Janice wasn't the type of kid who let you feel bad for her.
"So you know about these papers," Jackie said.
"King City," the proffered paper said.
"Oh, boy, yes," Steve said. "Lots of folks have been getting those. Some fellow with a tan jacket. Oh, what's his name? I forget. I keep forgetting a lot about him. He's handing them out. I saw some folks at the bowling alley the other night. A whole team on lane 19 just sitting there crying and clutching their left fists. I saw some of the stalkers at the Ralph standing in front of empty shelves, staring to the sky, small slips of paper hanging from their slack fingers. Every now and then, I'd see someone shake the paper away, and it would spiral toward the linoleum floor, only to flutter back up into their hands, and collectively, they would moan. Once you get one, you can't let go of it. Suppose that guy handing them out has a reason, but it might just be a hobby. I've been thinking of taking up beekeeping, but, you know, bees need a lot of space to run around, and they're expensive unless you keep them on a farm, and then what's the point of having a pet you can't keep in your apartment?"
This was how it was with Steve, the important bit buried in a lot of meandering digression.
"A man in a tan jacket?"
"Sure, holding a deerskin suitcase. Don't remember much about him than that. I took a picture of him. I think I have it around here somewhere."
He stuck the upper half of his body into a shelf and started shuffling papers around. As he searched, several other stacks of paper fell on the floor, and he came back up, sweating a bit from the exertion. Jackie felt repulsed by Steve. She had no idea why. He had never been anything other than kind to her, kind to everybody. As the old saying went, not all windowless vans have residential surveillance equipment. In other words, not everything can be as good as it seems.
"Well, isn't that funny? I just can't seem to keep it in my mind where that photo is," Steve said. "It's the darndest thing. Whoa!"
He waved his arms at her. She held her hands up, fingers splayed. The paper dropped, and dropped again, and dropped again.
"You were almost leaning on the popcorn machine there," Steve said. "Don't want to do that."
"It's not even hot, man," Jackie said, about to touch the machine to demonstrate.
"No, don't."
His voice cracked. She sighed at the oppression of conventional wisdom, but dropped her hand.
So the man in the tan jacket has been giving the paper out to lots of people?
Not sure how many, but certainly a good amount. Old woman Josie has one, but I suppose you know that. I hear even Stacy got one recently,